Today at Radio Verulam, we're taking a journey from domestic politics across to America to analyse the recent election and the win of President-elect Joe Biden. To help fully understand what went on, I have the pleasure of welcoming on Dr. Sinead McEnany from the Open University, who specialises in gender protest and race in the USA, with a special interest on the ways that conservatism was reshaped in the 1960s. Sinead, before we get into the discussions today, how have you been coping during these strange times? Has COVID affected your ability to research? And also, are you in the festive spirit?
I am in a festive spirit. I am knee-deep in festive activities insofar as Tier 3 will allow here in Birmingham. The tree is up and the Christmas shopping is largely done. In terms of research, I'm quite lucky that I'm working on a couple of projects for which the archival research is already done. So it is really a question of just writing some materials now based on the archival research that I've previously completed. So all good. I think in the greater scheme of things, life is reasonably straightforward despite the peculiar environment we find ourselves in.
Well, that's good to hear, Sinead, that your research hasn't been too affected and you've been relatively good in these COVID times, and also that your research is coming to a close as well so that you can put everything together. But I want to bring it on to what has been dominating this festive period, dominated 2020 and the last few years as well. It's been on everybody's minds, this 2020 election. But before we jump into analysing the election itself, I actually wanted to ask the journey to what is seemingly a strange jump to both ends of the political scale. So how did we get from Obama to Trump and back to Biden in such a short amount of time, Sinead?
Good question. And I'm not sure that I can give you a pithy answer. There are a couple of ways of thinking about this shift from Obama to Trump and Biden. One way is to think of Trump as the continuation of a shift towards a particular kind of conservatism that has dominated US politics really since the Reagan era. So I know that the presidents have been, you know, we've had various Democratic presidents, but the general politicization of the United States has become more and more polarized, and it is defined by new conservatism rather than by anything else. So this is one of the reasons why the language around socialism has become so weaponized, because it's in contradistinction to the conservatism that has brought Trump into the White House. So if you say it that way, Obama is the anomaly. And Trump is not the anomaly. And I suppose what defines the Trump presidency is the acceleration of and the extremism of this version of conservatism that really you can, as I say, trace back to the 1980s, even the 1970s. So I don't know whether we got from Obama to Trump and Biden in a short amount of time. I think that there is a continuum here at work. I think Biden represents also continuity. He has been in politics for as long as I've been alive. So the idea that he somehow represents change in a US political system is not correct. He is in lots of ways the continuity candidate, and an awful lot of what we see at the moment are reactions both on the left and the right to the sorts of debates that have been ongoing for really quite some time.
Just continuing that thread, because a lot of news outlets, a lot of historians have actually talked about this Reaganism of the 80s that brought about the problems we see today. The Atlantic have actually pointed to Newt Gingrich, but the current problems we see in America all seem to go back to the Republican Party. Is it an oversimplification to look at just the 1980s as the birth of all these problems, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, I would probably say it's the 1970s where you get this shift in conservatism after the recalibration, if you like, of US politics in the 1960s in response to the civil rights movement and the Southern strategy, which really meant that the proponents of racism in the Southern Democratic Party, for the most part, jumped and joined the Republican Party. So the Nixon period into the early 1970s. And the adoption then by the Republican Party of a whole host of socially conservative standpoints, most famously, probably, there's the Republican stance against abortion reform, and the connection between socially conservative groups like Focus on the Family and the Republican Party. So you get a recalibration in the 1970s, which then fuels the Reagan period in the early 1980s. And you mentioned Newt Gingrich. Gingrich himself what became political in the 1970s, but his real contribution, if you like, to where we are today comes in the early 1990s, and particularly in his stance against Bill Clinton and the way that he sort of weaponizes social conservative positions in order to create and exacerbate these culture wars that we talk about today and that we have been talking about really since the end of the 1980s. So I'm not sure that I would say that the Republican Party is responsible for the current problems that we see in America today, but I would say that the diametrically opposed viewpoints that we see, particularly in terms of social issues, do have their roots in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and then a whole host of political actors like Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove play on these cultural issues, these kind of social issues, to create difference and mobilize a voter base, particularly in an America which is becoming more and more polarized through the 1990s and into the early 2000s between rural and urban. And so, if you see what happens in the 2020 election campaign, for the most part, and I don't want to be too crude about this, but for the most part, the Democrats dominate East Coast and West Coast, and also dominate the urban centers, even in those states where we call them purple states, the states where it's a kind of a toss-up between the Republicans and the Democrats. And this is one of the reasons why Trump was so keen to try and undermine the voting activities in big cities in conservative states like Georgia, Pennsylvania, and New Mexico, and all of these other places that he was, Michigan to a lesser extent, and Wisconsin to a lesser extent. They're much more fluid, I guess, in their political positions in some of the southern states. But it's really about really what you can see with Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove in the 80s and the 90s and into the early 2000s is this kind of weaponization of social conservatism in a brand new way.
Bringing that to the present, the weaponization of politics, there's been a lot of angry, powerful rhetoric during this election and probably in the 2016 election as well. But news outlets such as The Independent have described the 2020 election campaign as toxic and that this dangerous rhetoric was used too much. Would you agree with this sentiment that this was the most dangerous election in US history?
The most dangerous election in US history happened in 1860. So that was the election that Abraham Lincoln won Even though he was not on the ballot in a whole host of states, he still managed to win the election. And there you see the division of the United States really into sections, the pro-slavery and the anti-slavery section. And that was the most dangerous election in US history, which produced 4 years of civil war. So I wouldn't go as far as to say that we're quite at that point, although you can see that an awful lot of the language being used by lots of different political actors at the moment kind of harks back to this idea that there is a civil war ongoing in the United States. And this civil war is between two sides who increasingly have nothing between them to agree on. And partly that is because of the toxic language, but partly it's also to do with the shift over the past 20 years or so. And again, I'd probably blame Newt Gingrich for quite a lot of this, that bipartisanship has completely broken down. So this is one of the things that Joe Biden was keen to emphasize in his own campaign, is that he has a track record of bipartisan agreement, that he would be a symbol of a rebirth of bipartisanship within within the Capitol, within Congress. Whether this is true or not is up for debate, and whether this is possible or not within the current divisions in politics, we will have to see. But I think that's where the danger really lies, is that neither side seems to be able to agree on anything. They can't even agree on facts. They can't agree on what's real and what's not real. I think even more dangerous than the rhetoric that people are using is the, and I put my hand up here, I'm absolutely in favor of the left in politics here. So I'm, you know, I don't claim to be completely unbiased in terms of politics, perhaps in history, but not in politics. But the abandonment of truth, particularly, although not exclusively, by Trump supporters, is probably the scariest part of what has happened over the last 4 or 5 years. And the ability of, you know, perfectly sane congressmen and women in the Republican Party, their ability to accept a whole host of conspiracy theories and a whole host of outright lies by the president has really shaken, I think, the foundation of the political system. The American political system we think of as something that's quite robust. It's been ongoing now for over 200 years. It's largely unchanged as a system in those 200 years. But it is still quite a delicate balance, and it is based on knowing consent. It works most efficiently when everybody involved in the political system is trying to act in a way that is good for the nation. And if that sounds terribly naive, that's essentially what the system was built on. This system doesn't handle complete self-interest of the political actors. It doesn't really do well when those who are involved in politics act almost exclusively in their own self-interest, which is really what we've seen more and more of over the last 4 or so years.
Completely linked to this is all the discussion point so far since the election, but I do have to ask the question before we delve into it a little bit more. But is there any truth in these claims of substantial voter rigging?
No.
None whatsoever. So no. Even these claims of Trump bringing it to the law courts, is he just wasting their time?
Yes. These are easy questions to answer. So, I mean, there is absolutely no, there are clearly going to be, it's a huge country with a lot of variation between states in terms of their voter systems. So it's not like in the UK where there's a kind of central control over your voting systems. Each state has its own voting system, so you're really talking about 51 individual voting sets of voting regulations at play here. So it is absolutely the case that in some instances there have been irregularities, but absolutely nothing to indicate that there's anything systemic in terms of voter fraud. So fraud implicates intent. What we do have indication of is that there were errors from time to time, but in those states where Donald Trump sought to challenge the outcomes of the voting, there is absolutely no indication at all that there is any systematic attempt to undermine the regularity of voting. So voter rigging, and this is something that he's been talking about ever since he started his term of office, is that, you know, there's some kind of deep-seated problem with the voting system. So in lots of ways, he's spent 4 years working up to this point where he's been priming his supporters to believe that there's something wrong with the voting system. But I mean, logically speaking, if there were something wrong with the voting system, if there were systematic fraud, you would have imagined that more Democrats would have been elected to the Senate or to the House of Representatives, and that didn't happen. So what we did see was split tickets where declared Republican supporters were voting a Republican slate but also voting for Biden. And that doesn't tell you that there's fraud, that just tells you that the election was complicated.
Now, in history, these claims of voter rigging or voter irregularities are not uncommon. You know, two big examples are John F. Kennedy's victory in the 60s, and obviously in the 2000s, George Bush had the much publicized victory over Al Gore, but questions were asked then. What makes the actions of Donald Trump different and more nefarious than these other incidents?
So, I mean, that's a good question. The 1960 election with John F. Kennedy versus Nixon, in which the accusation was, and I think there's a certain amount of truth to this, that sort of strings were pulled in order to convince lots and lots of people to vote for Kennedy. However, Kennedy won that election, right? He didn't win it by 100,000 votes. He won that election. In 2000, the case is slightly different, and that is the what was it, 500 or so votes in Florida that were disputed around this. If I certainly remember, you almost certainly don't, the so-called hanging chads, pregnant chads or hanging chads, which referred to the clarity of indication of intent to vote. So people were using machines in order to essentially punch a card, a voting card, and those punch marks should have been punched right through the paper, but they were not, and George Bush took claim to the Supreme Court that to the courts in Florida, at least, in order to question whether these votes should be validly counted or not. And I guess what's different between the 2000 election and the election now is that we could see, like, Al Gore could have challenged this further. He could have done a Donald Trump on it. He could have mounted all kinds of judicial legal actions to try and win the election. But I think what Gore did and I'm not saying that Gore is any kind of paragon of virtue in this instance, but I think he could see that the kind of direction of travel was in favor of George Bush. And rather than, and of course, there was no precedent for this kind of activity anyway, really, candidates generally didn't make these kinds of outlandish challenges that we see Donald Trump making now. But I think what Gore was anxious to do was to kind of draw a line under the election and move on. Possibly he had the intention of being able to run again in 4 years' time. Possibly he just thought that it was the right thing to do. Donald Trump, and again, this goes back to people acting of the country or acting in their own self-interest. And clearly what Donald Trump is doing here is acting in his own self-interest.
Now, bring it back again to a bit of history. 1932 election obviously saw the overturn of Herbert Hoover, with Franklin Delano Roosevelt coming in with a very progressive set of policies. But in that transition period, which was then shortened because of some of the actions that went on, Herbert Hoover used this time period to actually put some potential blocks in to the reforms that Roosevelt was proposing. Is this something that is within reach that Trump could do? And do you actually envisage him actually doing anything to stop Biden?
I think he certainly has the capacity, and in fact, he has already made some moves to stymie some of the campaign priorities that Biden has already announced will be kind of first on his list of things to do. I would say that Hoover had a bit longer, actually. So it used to be that presidents were inaugurated in March, the March following the election. So Roosevelt was elected in November, and he was due to take office and did take office in March 1933. So Hoover actually had a couple of extra months. And not only, I guess, did he try to block the potential reforms that Roosevelt was planning to make, he was also he also had to steward the country through a very difficult economic period. And he sort of saw that as something that was within his remit. And in lots of ways, he was right. And Trump is also right that he is president until that, you know, moment when Joe Biden is sworn in. So he is entirely within his political rights, even though it may not be morally defensible to do so. He is entirely within his political constitutional rights to continue to do whatever it is that he wants to do with the support of Congress. And he will.
So let's move on to president or president-elect Joe Biden, because as we've mentioned there, Trump may do some things to stop the policies that Biden and Harris want to bring in. But what should Americans expect? What kind of policies will Biden and Harris bring to the table once they are in office?
I mean, I think Biden and Harris have kind of laid out their political priorities. It was an extraordinarily unusual election campaign dominated by the pandemic. So you can imagine that, in fact, he has said that in his first 100 days, he wants to try and get the pandemic under control. He wants to try and deal with the financial hardship that many American families have felt because of the economic downturn. And the environment is very high on his list of priorities. So he is interested in the Paris Accords. He's interested in trying to take action, meaningful action on the environment. Those first 100 days will be very tricky, and all of this will depend on how much he can get Congress on side. He will arrive in the presidency with a much smaller majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives than he ought to have done. So the Democrats lost, I think it was 9 seats. I stand to be corrected. I think it was about 9 seats in the election, which makes their majority much smaller going into the new term, which will start on the 3rd of January. He will also, we will also see what's going to happen with the Senate. And you probably know that there are 2 Senate seats still to be decided in the state of Georgia. And of course, this also explains why Donald Trump is so keen to undercut the voter voter integrity of the state of Georgia, because it may well affect the Republican hold on the Senate if these, well, it will affect the Republican hold on the Senate if Republicans lose both of these seats in Georgia to Democratic challengers. So what Biden can do in, and what his, how much of his campaign promises that he can start taking action on as soon as he comes into office will largely depend on how cooperative his congressional colleagues are.
Sinead, to better contextualize and maybe put a better understanding of what policies or what parties or even politicians past and present in Britain, what would they be comparable to, Biden and Harris, in terms of British politics, Labour, Conservative, Lib Dems?
That's a really hard question, mostly because I'm not enough versed in British politics to be able to give you a good answer that a historian of British politics would be able to give you. I mean, I've always found it very difficult to compare British politics and American politics, because between Trump and Boris Johnson is so off the mark. It's just such a different kind of system. I mean, Biden, for lots of people, Biden is a completely centrist candidate. All of these suggestions that Biden's election will somehow herald, you know, the Venezuela system becoming central to the United States, this is all ludicrous. He's extremely centrist, and does not represent a great shift from the past. Harris is also extremely centrist. You know, her own political record speaks to, and her judicial, her as a lawyer and as an attorney general, you know, she's not some kind of lunatic left wing, you know, Marxist. Yeah, I mean, you would swear that they want to nationalize everything. This is not going to happen. So these are pretty straight down the line centrist politicians who I think will want to get back to some kind of bipartisanship and will want to try and, I mean, if they're smart, they'll want to try and fix some of the problems that have created this enormous split between the so-called red parts of the United States and the blue parts. We can't even talk about red states and blue states, but the urban rural divide. And in fact, I saw a really good, I don't usually agree with Thomas Friedman, but I saw a really, really good article in the New York Times today by Friedman, who suggested that it would be a good idea to give Kamala Harris a portfolio to try and fix rural America. So to bring broadband to rural America, to improve the economic situation in rural, in what is largely, or at least people feel like is forgotten parts of the United States. These places are the heartland of Trumpism. They feel like they've been forgotten, and so they have nothing to lose by rocking the system. And the Democrats have lost these people, and they have lost them now for at least 3-4 elections. And if Biden and Harris are smart, they should try and improve the lives of these people so that they are more likely to vote Democrat in the next set of elections. Remember, the next election cycle is in 2 years' time. So we think about American elections in 4-year cycles because we think about the general election with the president, but actually there are elections in the United States every 2 years, national elections every 2 years. And so, you know, so they have 2 years to try and fix some of this feeling amongst forgotten Americans that they matter. Maybe it's optimistic to think that they would be able to do that, but certainly I think that's what they should do. And again, that makes it very difficult to make comparisons between Biden and Harris and UK election systems or like politicians.
Now, speaking of optimism there, Joe Biden has been portrayed as a great bipartisan negotiator. You know, there's the example of getting the financial deal done during the financial crisis. And indeed, in the build-up to the 2020 election, he said, "I am the person who has worked across the aisle. With your help, I can do it again." However, with the current situation in American politics, is this ability to get cross-party agreement no longer possible? Is this an untenable, maybe over-nostalgic look at politics?
It's tricky to know really how this will pan out. So there are lots of moving parts. The first is the personalities involved. Mitch McConnell has become a kind of a demon to Democrats, and he revels in it. And he has grabbed an enormous amount of power as the majority leader in the Senate. He has dug his heels in over everything. He refuses to engage in any kind of bipartisanship. And it's hard to know whether this is purely for personal power, or whether he also has been trying, and maybe it's a bit of both, trying to leverage this power in order to get a conservative foothold in strategic places like the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is now resoundingly conservative with the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett before the election. So we now have a 6-3 conservative split on the Supreme Court. And in lots of ways, that means that the court, with very few elderly people on it now, Clarence Thomas, I think, is the oldest now, but the court is now settled. Even if Thomas was to leave the court for whatever reason, either through resignation or death, in Biden's term, even a new left-leaning justice, liberal justice, would not upend the conservative majority on that court. And so there's no need to leverage anymore, right, on that. The other thing that has been holding up bipartisanship is lack of trust between both sides. I don't know whether that can be overcome. I don't know whether that is something that can be undone in 2 years or 4 years. It's been brewing for a long time, and it is fueled as well in the House of Representatives by the sense that people have that Nancy Pelosi is doing for Democrats in the House what Mitch McConnell is doing for Republicans in the Senate, and that is that she wants to hold on to this power, that she sees, the House of Representatives as her personal powerhouse, her personal fiefdom, and that she is also against bipartisanship in the House of Representatives. And so this kind of mistrust on both sides makes bipartisanship very difficult, and these sorts of personalities make bipartisanship very difficult. It would be interesting to see what happens if at some point over the next 2 to 4 years, one or other of those characters was no longer there. And we'll see what happens in that respect. But I mean, Biden himself knows a lot about a lot of people. In this, he's not unlike Lyndon Johnson. When Johnson became president after the assassination of Kennedy in 1963, Johnson had a long-standing association with politics. Had been a He was elected during the Roosevelt era. And he knew everything about everybody. That's a very important weapon to have. And that's all I would say about Biden and his bipartisanship. I think he's in as good a position as anybody could be to manipulate his erstwhile colleagues to do things that they might not ordinarily want to do.
And bringing it maybe to a relationship that, you know, means a lot to us as people in Britain, the Biden administration, will it continue this special relationship? What kind of relationship will we expect between Boris Johnson or whoever may be the incumbent prime minister and the Biden administration?
Oh, if I could see into the future, I would be in a different job. I don't know the answer to that, Jason. I do know. I mean, this idea of the special relationship is largely a mythology now, and I think that the US have done a lot of diplomacy over the years with the EU. Whether they see value in Britain outside of the EU, it's hard to tell. There is, of course, a historical connection, and there is, of course, a kind of an emotional connection between Britain and the United States. But I mean, for the most part, Biden and Harris and the various parties trying to steward American interests internationally. They will do deals that benefit America. So I know that we may make a lot about Trump and America First and his very nationalistic protectionist approach. But I do think that this is not something that's going to disappear overnight. I also don't think it's necessarily something that Trump, invented out of thin air himself. Well, first of all, he borrowed it from the 1930s, but he certainly didn't invent it out of thin air, even in more recent political strategy. I mean, American politicians will do whatever suits America best. They are the ones with the power. When the UK was part of the EU, the power differential was a lot more, it was a lot closer. The US and the EU was, you could sort of see that there was some kind of parity of power in supranational institutions. Now, with the UK out of the EU, the power differential is quite considerably increased, and the United States, to the United States, what is Britain really, other than a relative outlier with a impressive history?
We continue this future thinking. I know you said if you could look into the future, you'd have a different job. But I do want to talk about the future of American politics because, you know, all the discussion that we've had today speaks of a fragmented American political system. But, you know, looking at the Republican Party, the New Yorker described it as having an identity crisis. But also, with the voter numbers, Trump still got 46.9% of the vote. As you mentioned yourself, the Democrats missed out on a lot of these rural voters, and they have a problem appealing to large sections of the electorate. Will we see a shift in both the Republican and Democratic ideologies going forward from 2020?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say let's talk about the Democrats first. So the Democrats have a huge problem in that they have lost vast swathes of what we would have called blue-collar workers, particularly in the Rust Belt, so the Wisconsin and Michigan, sort of old industrial heartland, that would have been pretty solidly Democratic up until relatively recently. They're now on the fence. So they voted for Biden this time, but it was close. They didn't vote for Hillary last time. They voted for Trump last time. So that's a shift, and Democrats are going to have to do something about that and to find some way of articulating a position that appeals to these folks who feel that they are being spoken down to by elites, that they are that their difficulties are not taken as seriously as other constituencies, rightly or wrongly. That's how they feel. That's what they're telling you at the polling booth. Whether they can do that, I don't, and stay truthful or close to their social program is hard to know, and particularly the ways that the Democratic Party, I think quite rightly, have embraced positions around fighting back against racism and have embraced, you know, socially progressive positions that have alienated conservative voters who may well have been able to vote Democrat in the past, but now can't. Don't see a way for them to do that. It's tricky. The one big change in the 2020 election was the number of Latino voters who voted for Trump, perhaps counterintuitively given his position on the famous wall and his relationship with Mexico. But we see a split really between Latino voters in places like Florida and in places like Arizona. So we cannot talk about a block of Hispanic or Latino voting anymore, even if we may not have ever been able to accurately talk about that. But we certainly can talk about it now. And it will be interesting to see how the Republican Party capitalize on that, given that they do have an identity crisis and that they are rapidly going to run out of the kind of white rural base that they have traditionally relied on. What I would say is that the big story of the 2020 election was voter turnout. And it's very clear that when you make it easier for Americans to vote, and in this case it was pandemic related, but more Americans voted by mail-in ballot or early voting than has ever been the case before. When you make it easier for Americans to vote, they will turn out. And that poses a problem for the Republican Party, for whom voter suppression was a long-term tactic, and has been really since the 1960s. For the Republican Party strategists, the fewer people who vote, particularly the fewer people who vote in cities, the better for them. The Democratic Party has always sought to increase the number of people who vote and to make it easier for people to vote, particularly people who feel marginalized in particular minority categories. With the shift towards mail-in voting and a system that would make it easier for people to vote, it might be much harder to predict what will happen in the future.
One of the finer points I want to talk about is actually, again, the future of American politics. But do you have a positive feeling about it? Do you think that things will change? How positive are you that the changes that will happen over the next few years, maybe to the 2022 elections or the 2024 election, are going to be in the right direction?
It's really too early to say. I think that the political landscape over the past 20, 30 years has been much more about wedge issues, about driving home differences between people rather than similarities. I think that the polarization of the American voting population is extremely dangerous. And I think that it will be very hard to fix that polarization and to recalibrate the political landscape in a way that can produce, you know, any kind of unity across the nation. So I wish I could be super positive and say, well, Biden and Harris now have an opportunity to change the, you know, to shift the dial, to change the tone of politics across the board. But I suspect that that's just naive. I think that that's just not a tenable position to take. And I think that things are going to continue to be fractious. The advent of newer platforms on social media occupied by one or other camp where nobody talks to each other and you're just basically in your own echo chamber is also not helpful. The fact that the news media is so polarized is not helpful. So, if you are interested in having somebody reinforce your worldview, whatever side of the political spectrum you are, you can have that, and you can arrange your life in a way that does not require you to ever engage with the other side. And as long as that continues to be the case, it will be very easy for people to demonize the opposition and paint the opposition as people who are fundamentally bad or stupid or anti-American. And in most cases, none of this is true. In most cases, there probably are lots of points that connect people rather than divide them. But the entire political landscape is set up in a way to reward political parties for their ability to create wedges in the political population. So I'm not terribly positive, I guess.
Well, we can be positive about one thing today, and that you've been a fantastic guest, Sinead. It has been a real delight to talk to you.
Likewise.
My final question to you, though, is, you're talking about information there, fake news, and the problems of bipartisanism or a breakdown of relations in politics in America. But one of the good ways to combat that is good, impartial information, or as impartial as it can be in this realistic world. So, for the listeners, is there a good source of information that you can recommend for them? Maybe a book or a magazine or a YouTube channel that possibly is a stocking filler this Christmas, so that they can catch up with all the important things in American politics.
You mentioned The Atlantic earlier on, and The Atlantic Monthly has been running since the 1850s, and it claims to be as impartial a source of news as it's possible to have. And in lots of ways, over different periods of time, it's kind of swung one way or the other. It is still my go-to place for good news coverage, and it makes me crazy because, David Frum, who used to be one of George W. Bush's advisors, is, I think he may well still be the editor, but he's certainly a leading correspondent for them. And he did a spell as editor. He is one of the architects of Bush's conservatism, and he has a lot to say in the pages of The Atlantic. But you'll also find, proponents of different political positions in the Atlantic. It is by no means a conservative news magazine. So I would say that it is my go-to place for fairly impartial and certainly well-informed and meticulously researched, for the most part, information.
Well, a huge thank you for your time today, Sinead. And of course, a very Merry Christmas to you. I hope you have a fantastic festive period.
And to you too, Jason, and to your listeners.